And we are rolling. Hey, Maggie.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Good, good. So this is Mark Goldberg with the UN and Global Affairs blog, UN Dispatch, speaking with Maggie Fick from the Enough Project. We're going to be talking today about sort of the lesser known but equally important conflict in Sudan, the conflict in South Sudan, as opposed to the more widely known conflict in Darfur. This is something Maggie has been working on for quite a long time at the Enough Project. I know I've had folk from the Enough Project on UN Plaza before, but for our uninitiated audience's sake, could you maybe explain what the Enough Project is?
Absolutely. So the Enough Project is part of the larger and growing anti-genocide movement here in the United States. We focus on having field research and sort of using field knowledge to inform our strategy papers that are geared at really a wide audience, a diverse audience, not necessarily policymakers, not necessarily other think tank audience, but more of a broad constituency that we're trying to reach. We focused initially on Sudan, particularly on Darfur when we were founded in 2007, along with Congo and the conflict in the Lord's Resistance Army throughout Central Africa. And as Mark mentioned, we are now focusing increasingly on the situation in southern Sudan, and that is what my efforts are focused on as a researcher on our policy team. So that's a little bit about our background, about Enough, and just I would emphasize that we work to sort of connect field-based knowledge with activist actions that are targeted primarily at the U.S. government.
So with that, talk us through the conflict in South Sudan. What's it all about? Why should we care? What does it mean, for audiences in the United States?
Fair enough. So
the floor is yours.
Sorry. Oh, thank you. All right. So as you might know, Sudan gained independence in 1956, and the country has been largely at war with itself since independence. There's been two wars between the North and the South, with only a brief respite between these two civil wars in the 1970s. Sudan's longest conflict in almost 23 years was between the North and the South, and it ended in 2005 with the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement between the northern government in Khartoum, which is still in power, of course, the National Congress Party, and the South Sudan People's Liberation Movement Army, the SPLMA. So these two parties were at war, as I said, from 1983 to 2005. The conflict displaced over 4 million people, forced them from their homes and into neighboring Ethiopia and Kenya, and resulted indirectly or directly in the deaths of over an estimated 2.5 million people. So for people or for activist groups that have come at Sudan from the context of Darfur, they may be somewhat less familiar with the North-South conflict, but it essentially decimated the South. I was recently in southern Sudan in May and June, and it is a bleak place in the sense that underdevelopment is a huge problem. It's very much a post-conflict setting that's been recovering slowly from the effects of, as I said, nearly four decades of war. So backing up a little bit back to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which was signed in 2005, this is really a landmark agreement that the U.S. played a key role in negotiating, along with a number of other nations such as the U.K. and France, Norway, and a troika, they called it. So this agreement was basically brought both sides to the table and is very comprehensive. It's a complicated agreement with a number of protocols. It's a complex agreement, and all of the parties, the international community that was involved in the signing of this, in the negotiating the agreement, agreed to support the implementation of it in a six-year period from 2005 to 2011. We're currently in what's called the CPA's interim period. So in 2005, when the agreement was signed in Naivasha, Kenya, nations like the U.S., also the Arab League, the African Union, agreed to support the implementation of this complex agreement. They knew that the South was devastated after the war. They knew that this would take time. And the idea was to make unity between the North and the South attractive before 2011, when the South will vote in a self-determination referendum. So that phrase, make unity attractive, is kind of behind this agreement. Also the idea of a, quote, democratic transformation of Sudan. So some of the key, I'll just briefly go through a couple of the key provisions of this agreement. One is the general elections, which are set to occur in April 2010, but have already been delayed twice. And so we'll see how that progresses. The U.S. is actually supporting those elections to the tune of $95 million. So they're the largest single donor in those elections. And then the other significant agreement that I mentioned is the referendum on Sudan, on Southern Sudan's independence, which is set to occur in 2011. And then I guess I'll stop there. I hope that gives a little bit of a background on the agreement and where we're at today.
Yeah, I mean that sounds good. So you know the top line summary, I guess, is one, the 2005 agreement, you know, created this sort of unity government for this interim period that you described. Two, it paves the way for elections sometime early next year, and then finally a referendum on southern independence. So I mean, what? So I guess where are we? Are we on track on this? You said that the elections were delayed. But, you know, my understanding, and you probably know, I'm sure you know better than I, is that, you know, there's oil in the mix here, and a lot of the oil in Sudan comes from southern Sudan.
Absolutely.
And that the government in Khartoum, the central government, is likely not willing to let go of these oil fields. So it seems that we are almost headed for, you know, headed for some sort of conflict ahead of this ahead of the referendum. Is that correct?
Yes, I would say that
is that an accurate representation of where you think things stand?
I think so. Unfortunately, I think you are reading the tea leaves correctly in terms of the situation today between the North and the South. As I mentioned, when the agreement was signed in 2005, these guarantor nations agreed to help support the implementation of the agreement. But sort of the story is that everyone flew out of Kenya the next day and never really called back. And so there hasn't been implementation of a lot of the key sort of preparatory provisions, if that makes sense, for the elections and the referendum. So that means, for example, holding the census, the first census that's been held in Sudan in 20 years. That process was delayed. It was contested. It continues to be contested, both by the government in the north and the southern government in Juba. As I should have mentioned, the government of southern Sudan is a semi-autonomous government that was created in 2005 for this interim period and may become the government of an independent state in 2011. But there has been sort of a climate of increasing tensions recently over failure of both sides to implement the agreement, but in particular intransigence from the government in Khartoum. There's a lot of examples, as I mentioned, the census, a lot of broken agreements, a lot of some would say bad faith between the parties. And as you mentioned, oil is kind of at the root of all of it. There are a great deal of oil fields right along the contested north-south border. That brings up yet another contested provision of the CPA, which is that the north-south border has not been demarcated. It is, again, one of the to-be-decided issues within the CPA, but there's been a commission established to assess the boundary, but as of yet, they've reportedly drawn about a third of it, starting on Ethiopia and going westward. But that is yet another issue that's likely to be contested. And I think we're going to talk more about Abyei in a little bit, which is an area that has been the site of particular problems in terms of implementation.
Well, you seem to have served it right up. So, one of the reasons we're doing this, we're having this chat right now, is that you and the UNEP project wrote a report on sort of the contested so-called Abyei region, which you argue is a flashpoint that could, and sort of events in Abyei could, spark a renewed sort of war between the North and the South. So I guess maybe to the average sort of viewer, talking about a region of southern Sudan seem sort of a little in the weeds, but
right.
I think the point you make in the report is interesting that, you know, if there is a renewed conflict, it will likely be over this Abyei region, so you know we ought to inform ourselves. So why don't you take it from there?
Exactly. Well, thank you for setting it up that way, because I agree it could seem somewhat in the weeds, hard to pronounce, where is this region. But the essential thing to know is that it has been a flashpoint, this area called Abyei. It might help to have a map, but unfortunately we don't have one right now. Basically, just think of it as smack dab in the middle of Sudan at the crossroads of north and south. The interesting thing is that politics in this region have really amplified to a national level repeatedly. You have the Arab Misriya herders who pass through and migrate seasonally through the lands of Abyei, and then you also have the Ngokdinka people who are southern farmers. And these populations peacefully coexisted for decades, for centuries, but during the Civil War that I mentioned, their identities really hardened, and both sides, you could say, were sort of instrumentalized or used by the northern and southern governments. So this area, Abyei, has been a flashpoint, as I said, and that's why it was the subject of a particular protocol within the CPA. And again, this is an area that the U.S., under the Bush administration, under a different special envoy named John Danforth, in the early 2000s, negotiated this protocol because they knew it would be a contested issue. They knew it would be significant to the future of Sudan. So this protocol established that a special committee of experts, a panel of experts, would determine the contested boundaries of Abyei. Now, the reason it's contested is because both the North and South lay claim to this area, and as you alluded to, there is significant oil reserves in this area. So to make a long story short, after the panel of experts issued their report in 2005 after the signing of the peace agreement demarcating the boundaries, the National Congress Party absolutely refused to accept these borders, even though they had agreed to in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. So they said that they basically, President Bashir said something to the effect of the experts should soak their report in water and drink it. So kind of like, eat it, you know, your report doesn't matter and we're not going to accept it. So when
stick
that happened,
where the sun don't shine sort of response.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what it was. So at any rate, there was just basically a period of stalemate that lasted for a couple of years where no one knew what the boundaries of Abyei were. They were contested. The North had refused to accept it. The Southern government was angry about this. Until May 2008, when you had a small clash between Northern and Southern security forces, army forces, this clash erupted and resulted in the displacement of 60,000 people from the town of Abyei. So that's what I'm talking about when I say that sort of a local level incident amplified into a much bigger situation and is sort of indicative of the kind of problems that this area can cause and the implications they have for North-South peace moving forward. So at any rate, when this happened in May 2008, this massive violence, the international community woke up a little bit, as has happened before in Sudan, and we continue to see diplomats rush to the scene kind of after the fact, after this massive incident had occurred, and decided that, oh yeah, we do need to do something, we do need to demarcate the borders of this region and figure out how we're going to move forward on this, and oh yes, we also need to worry about the north-south border. But at any rate, this region became the subject of an international arbitration centered in The Hague, so both parties, the North and the South, agreed to another agreement, another process for the boundaries of Abyei, and the reason we issued this report several weeks ago that you mentioned was that 2 weeks ago yesterday, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague issued their ruling on this contested region. So they were essentially deciding, and they've been working on this decision for the past 6 months since the parties came to The Hague. Again, a long story that you can read more about in the report. But the point is they were deciding whether or not the panel of experts that I mentioned had exceeded their mandate in demarcating the borders. So the thing that's significant about this is if the tribunal decided that they exceeded their mandate, then the borders would be withdrawn. So am I allowed to break the exciting news if you didn't hear it 2 weeks ago about the borders?
Break it.
Okay. So the tribunal...
Break it down. Go for it.
The tribunal...
The Hague Court of Arbitration's exciting news on Abyei.
Yes. Breaking news on Abyei, which you may have heard 2 weeks ago, but I'm just going to break it one more time. The Hague Court of Arbitration decided that the experts had partially exceeded their mandate, which means that the borders were then partially withdrawn. I can refer you to a 12-page press release, which I didn't find much of a press release. It was more of a complicated legal document. But the point is that...
We'll post a link to that for interesting parties. But I guess bottom line, who came out on top, who on bottom, who or is it not quite that clear cut?
Well, it's not quite that clear cut, and I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that question because it's a question that I think people are shying away from answering, and I actually am going to argue that it's important not to say one side won and one side lost because I think that tends to fuel tensions, and that is not necessarily it's not a productive thing to do. I think the bottom line is that this ruling is an opportunity for the North and the South to stick to their agreements and for the international community to back up the agreements that they have made. So I'm not going to dodge the question completely.
Well, maybe instead of asking you who came out on top, who on bottom, can I ask you how each party responded to the ruling?
That's a nice way to put it. So I'm going to say that both parties responded positively, saying that an impasse had been broken by this ruling, that this was an opportunity for peace and development for the people of Abyei. They stuck to commitments they had made a month before. In June, you probably remember, U.S. Special Envoy, President Obama's envoy to Sudan, Scott Gratian, convened a conference in Washington with the Sudanese party and with the international community. So basically, the results of this conference, the idea of getting implementation of this complex agreement back on track, were really on the spot with Abyei. And so, I mean, it was kind of a foregone conclusion that both parties would say, yes, we want to implement the ruling as we have committed to do. And so they went along with that the first day, right? In The Hague that day, they said, yes, this is a chance for peace. But the interesting thing is to see what's happened in the past 2 weeks, right? To see what's happened since this ruling has been issued. Do you mind if I go ahead with that a little bit?
Go for it.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that basically a significant thing, and this gets to the point of your question of who won, who lost, is that one of the oil fields, Hegleg oil field, a significant oil field that is apparently declining in output right now, but the point is that it used to be, it was within Abyei, and the tribunal has now drawn it outside of the boundaries of Abyei, and this is significant because now the North is claiming it as theirs. Because it now technically lies in a northern state called Southern Kordofan. And again, I might refer you to a map to check that out. But this is significant because the National Congress Party basically said, yes, the party in Khartoum, you know, now we have this oil field. So we're happy about
that.
So
that's like a win for them.
That would be a win for them. But the interesting thing is that subsequently, the SPLM party in the south said that, oh, well, that field is actually part of Unity State, which is a state in the south. And so they now plan to contest that location of the oil field in the subsequent north-south border demarcation process, which, as I said, is delayed, is not going well. There's supposedly a report that's going to be issued in September on that, but there's likely to be a subsequent tribunal process on that as well, unfortunately.
So they're kicking that one. It seems that the Court of Arbitration, where this all went down, is sort of an interesting sort of international legal forum.
Right.
In that, you know, states go there voluntarily and they voluntarily, you know, agree to submit themselves to, you know, to be bound by the finding of the court. But when push comes to shove, there's no real enforcement mechanism. So it really is up to the states, you know, keeping their word that they will abide by these. By these findings, and a parallel, not to get too in the weeds, but a parallel can be drawn to, you know, the situation along the border. There was also a border dispute in Ethiopia and Eritrea from 1997 to 2000, and like what happened in Abyei, the parties decided after fighting for a while to submit their sort of the exact demarcation of a contested border region to the Hague Permanent Court of Arbitration. The court, you know, handed down their ruling in a way that favored Eritrea to Ethiopia's disadvantage.
Right.
And instead of, you know, pulling back their troops, Ethiopia just said, you know, forget it.
Yep.
And there was no way of really forcing Ethiopia's hand other than, you know, there's no, I guess, formal mechanism of forcing Ethiopia's hand. Like there is, it's seemingly, no formal mechanism of forcing either one of the parties to abide by the Abyei ruling.
Right. Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head, Mark. I think that the situation along the Ethiopian-Eritrean border is really, it's a worst-case scenario that needs to be absolutely avoided in Sudan. As you know, that area continues to undermine security in the Horn of Africa. And the issue with Abyei, and what I want to emphasize, is that you're correct that if you just look at it at first glance, the Permanent Court of Arbitration has no official enforcement mechanism of the ruling. But within the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which I'm trying to stress, you know, was something that was fully supported by the U.S., by the international community, and on this particular issue of Abyei, the U.S. has shown a leadership role in the past, there is really, as I said, kind of a spotlight. This is really being thought of as ground zero for CPA implementation because both the northern and southern parties have come out saying that we are going to support this. They've agreed repeatedly. The day of the ruling, you had U.S. Special Envoy Scott Gratian and the head of the United Nations mission in Sudan, Ashraf Ghazi, on the ground with high-level delegations. So there's really, you know, that moment right after the ruling, there was the impression that there is going to be follow-up. There were statements saying that we need to disseminate information about this ruling, and you know, all of this rhetoric, which is of course just rhetoric, but it has the potential to become something significant for the people of Abyei. So I think it's really important to remember these commitments that we've heard not only from the Sudanese parties, but from the U.S., from the U.K., and from the United Nations. And it's also important to know that it's not surprising that violence didn't happen, of course, the day after the ruling when all eyes were on the region, but there's still a real chance that the situation could rekindle in the coming months, as I mentioned, as tensions continue to mount between the parties, between the North and South, in the run-up to the elections and the referendum. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of sustained attention in the form of a couple different mechanisms that, again, were laid out in the CPA, for example, funds to disseminate information about the ruling. It probably doesn't surprise you that there's no radio service in Abyei, there's no radio coverage, so the UN radio service can't disseminate the ruling that way. So you need to have a team that's going to go out to villages and explain what the rights of the people are now, according to this ruling. Does that make sense? That kind of it's going to be a sustained process. It needs to be, and there needs to be, you know, international support for it, both financially and diplomatically, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we could switch gears only slightly, and I can ask you sort of what and how the conflict in the South and the conflict in Abyei and the resolution of those conflicts plays in or interacts with the conflict in Darfur, which is, you know, largely seen as being something totally separate.
Absolutely. That's a great question. It's something that, as I mentioned, Enough and the other advocacy organizations like Genocide Intervention Network and Save Darfur are really trying to hammer home today, not only to activists, but especially to the U.S. government, especially as the contentious Sudan policy review continues, which we may get to. It's the issue of a comprehensive peace for Sudan and the idea that Sudan's multiple crises are completely interrelated. So you have the genocide in Darfur, you have the crisis in the, you have the North-South conflict that burned on for two decades, the millions of deaths in Sudan. There's a root cause of all these problems, and that cause is the government in Khartoum, largely. The fact that this exploitive, repressive government has, you know, systematically created different crises in different regions of the country, and proceeded to sort of, you know, juggle or hoodwink the international community into dealing with these issues in a not comprehensive way, in a disconnected way. So that's something that we're very much calling for now, is an all-Sudan approach, the idea that you can't address the sort of simmering tensions that are threatening to overflow between the North and the South right now, in the run-up to 2011, you can't address those separately from the Darfur peace process. And unfortunately, it's the reality that Sudan is a large country. It's very complex, and dealing with these problems at the same time can prove very difficult. But it's something that is absolutely imperative if there is going to be a change that will benefit the people of Sudan as a whole.
So I guess to that end, you alluded just now to this sort of policy review,
right,
that you know, that supposedly had been going on at the White House. So my understanding is that, you know, upon election, President Obama said he was going to do a you know, Sudan policy review,
right,
within 60 days of taking office. You know, we're now, you know, well past 60 days, and that review has not been complete. My understanding, you know, from reporting, from, you know, talking to folk, is that there's a key schism at really top levels of the White House. On the one hand, you have the president's special envoy to Sudan, who wants more constructive engagement with Sudan, who wants to be able to work with Sudan. And on the other hand, you have people that take more of a hardline approach. And sort of the prominent example of that is Susan Rice, the UN ambassador. And so this policy review seems to be stuck, that there has not been sort of a word from on high, sort of setting U.S. policy towards Sudan one way or the other.
No, I think
is that your understanding of how things are as well?
Yes, absolutely. That squares with my understanding as well, that there's really a very contentious debate that continues. You described it well. Another way to say it would be the idea of using incentives versus pressures with the government in Khartoum, or the idea of carrots versus sticks, and diplomacy talk, but the idea is that there are key members of Obama's administration that have very differing opinions on what is the right approach to working with the, or engaging, pressuring, working with the Sudanese government for a resolution, as I mentioned, of these multiple crises. There are certain people, as you mentioned, Susan Rice, who think that it is very crucial to keep in mind the history of this regime in Khartoum that's been in power for 20 years, and to not sort of not start from square one, as it were, with open hands. But the point I think that you hit on that is really key is that this policy is ultimately going to be decided from the top down by President Obama himself, who needs to approve this policy, right, before it's released. So I think that you're only going to see movement on that when President Obama decides, I honestly think, to take a stand and make the final decision, if that makes sense. I think it will remain locked. There's been, you know, multiple promises that it's going to be rolled out soon, but it's going to take leadership from Obama for this to actually happen.
Mm-hmm. So, and you can see sort of evidence of this schism pop up on occasion in the media when you have, for example, a statement from Gratian, you know, sort of saying that, you know, there are remnants of genocide, I think were his,
right.
was his term, you know, like a week after Susan Rice said that, you know, the genocide is ongoing. So you can see sort of this debate sort of pop up in sort of in the public. But, you know, for the record, what side do you come down on this debate?
Well, I would come down rather firmly on the side of pressures. I think that it is important, as I mentioned, to keep in mind the history of this government in Khartoum, to think about how they have manipulated previous special envoys and how they are quite adept at signing multiple agreements and not implementing any of them. So I think that if you look just at the past 4 years in terms of implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, that's one great example of a way in which they have sort of dodged, you know, gotten what they wanted by not outright breaking agreements, except perhaps in the case of Abyei, but just sort of stalling things. And I think this is something that, you know, that is certainly, we can expect it to happen again. So I think that the application or the use of incentives can only occur if it comes after we see significant progress, significant evidence that Khartoum is changing tact. And I honestly don't think we have seen that yet. And as you mentioned, there's been a lot of dissonance among members of the administration publicly. We certainly saw that last week on the Hill at the multiple Sudan hearings when Gratian testified and a number of other officials.
Mm-hmm. So this probably brings me to like a final topic I wanted to talk with you about, which is the utility of activism at this point in sort of the arc of what's happened around Sudan and Darfur. And the reason I bring this up is that a leader of the Save Darfur movement, Randy Newcomb, wrote probably about a month ago in Foreign Policy magazine that, you know, for reasons that you eloquently laid out earlier, sort of Sudan is at a critical turning point. And Newcomb's argument was that the next 18 months are going to be sort of critical for Sudan. And accordingly, you know, it's going to be sort of a critical marker of how the Save Darfur movement fares in the future, if we could call it a success or a failure. And so I wrote a response to that, saying, you know, essentially I think that's asking a little too much of activists, and that, you know, I think it's fair to call the Save Darfur movement like huge, you know, an amazing success when it comes to, you know, in terms of like the history of activist movements on foreign policy, on par with sort of the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s. And the reason I say this is not because, you know, things in Sudan are great. They're clearly not. But I say this because, you know, the movement made Darfur a household name. And we're at a point now where, you know, card-carrying members of the Save Darfur movement, people like Samantha Power, people like Susan Rice and Gail Smith, are now, you know, hold key positions in the institution that they once, the behavior of which they sought to change.
Right.
They're working in the White House. They're working for the administration. So, you know, the movement has sort of infiltrated the institution that it sought to change, which is, you know, the U.S. government. So That's kind of where I laid it out. I don't know how you fit in this debate or this discussion.
Well, I think I would have to respectfully disagree with you, Mark, that the movement has reached the end of its utility. I absolutely do not think that it's true. I don't think also at the same time that activists should be expected to get into the weeds, as we talked about, of this interagency policy debate that is going on right now. But I do think activists can continue and should continue to play an important role at this very crucial moment when we're about to find out in the next couple of weeks what the U.S. policy, what Obama's policy is going to be on Sudan. As you mentioned, in some ways you might call it a veritable dream team that's in the White House now in terms of the commitments we've heard from Biden, from Obama, from Clinton, in the past, passionate statements from Susan Rice. This team has the ability to implement a policy on Sudan that could bring peace, but there needs to be sustained pressure, some sustained light, sustained heat from the activist movement to remind, if they need reminding, I don't know if they do, but I would say to keep Sudan on the radar. And again, not just Darfur, but the issue of a comprehensive peace in Sudan. So I think when we're talking about what's going to come of this policy review, as we discussed, Obama is going to be the one who fundamentally makes a decision at the end of the day. And I think that activists are playing a role right now. We're seeing this very public discussion of carrots versus sticks. And I don't think it's about activists calling the State Department and asking for certain in-the-weeds, complicated requests. I think it's really about activists helping to shape some of the choices that are on the table. Again, I think we saw this last week with the discussion of a lot of issues such as sanctions on Sudan, on the issue of the state sponsors of terrorism. The fact that this issue is in the news, is staying on the radar screens of all these officials, that Hillary Clinton is needing to issue statements to clarify the U.S. position after Gratian testifies on the Hill, I think this means that this discussion is ongoing, that it's staying in the front, sort of in the front mind of the administration. And I think this simply wouldn't be the case if all the movement was doing now was raising awareness. I agree that raising awareness reaches the end of its utility. It has reached. I think that Darfur is a household name. That is a success of the movement. That doesn't mean it's time to move on to another conflict. It means that it's time to redouble efforts to end the conflict.
Mm-hmm. I guess I guess you touched on what my counter argument would be, which is that it seems, to the extent that resolution of the North-South conflict requires the implementation of the CPA, and to the extent that the implementation of the CPA requires the administration taking the Susan Rice hard Maggie Fick hardliner approach to pressuring the NCP into living up to its obligations in the CPA, then it does, at least to me, it seems hard to ask activists to get that deep into what is a interagency debate. At the same time, I don't mean to disparage the movement or activists at all. I think, like I said, it has been an amazing success, and I think that evidence of the success are there are a couple of more enduring institutions, the Enough Project being one, the Genocide Intervention Network being another, that sort of were formed out of the Save Darfur movement, not only to look just at one instance of genocide in Darfur, but to raise awareness of mass atrocities elsewhere around the world and try to nurture a community of activists that care about these issues, which I think is a lasting and an enduring success of the movement.
Right.
I'll give you the final word.
Well, I would agree that a positive outcome of this burgeoning, building anti-genocide movement is that it can be taken in new directions, that energy can be devoted to other crises, including Eastern Congo, the deadliest war in the world, enough as a campaign working to raise awareness about sexual violence and the issue of illicit minerals in Congo. I believe you've talked to my colleague about that, David Sullivan, in the past. But I really think that it's crucial to hammer home the point that this situation right now with Sudan is not about having activists understanding what exactly the right pressures are to use against Khartoum that can be classified. It doesn't need to be on the forefront of activist agenda. The point is that that Sudan needs to remain in the forefront of the American public, and it needs to be made clear at the White House that this is still a priority, this is still a concern of Americans, and that's why the pressure is going to stay on. So I think that it would really be a shame to take what you've mentioned as some of the successes of the movement. I would say it would be squandering them to sort of close up shop now and let it, let the experts take over, because there's still a lot that can be done even now that, as I said, that we have this sort of dream team of sorts in the White House. Now is the time when I think peace could be possible in Sudan, but not if we sort of, let things go and move on to something else.
All right. With that, Maggie, thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Thanks, Mark. It was great talking to you.
Good.
Hope we can do it again.
Good.